This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 57. Welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the USA Firearm Training Network, and I am your host, Riley Bowman. Today I'm also joined by, you've heard him before, but it's been a while since we've had him on, and that is, guess who, Matthew Marister. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you for having me again. It's great to be on the show with you again.
It's our pleasure, really. Like, we should have you on more.
Well, I got big shoes to fill for Jacob, so I'll try to do my best.
Great. So just to give folks a little bit of an idea of what we're covering today. Today we're going to be talking about all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, we've had another, shooting, the Cascade Mall shooting. Utah is going to try for constitutional carry. Again, they've tried to do it in the past. I think the last time was three years ago, something like that. But, you know, failed then. Don't know if it's going to go through this time or not, but we'll be talking about that. Also, Missoula, Montana, which I just was there like two and a half weeks ago. Yeah. I went up to Glacier National Park, spent about a week up there. And part of my trip, I stopped off in Missoula. And I did not know this at the time. I wish I had known this. Not that it would have made any difference, but anyway, we'll get into it. But Missoula just passed, in my opinion, controversial legislation, so we'll talk on that. And also, a New Jersey high school student gets suspended for working on a school project. So, and then, of course, as always, we are going to have a couple of justified stories today. We'll get into that. Plus a special little segment that we don't typically have this sort of thing, but we're going to talk about El Cajon, and Matthew knows a little thing or two about that. So I hope you guys will all look forward to today's episode of the Concealed Carry Podcast. Today being, of course, it's our usual Monday news episode of the podcast coming out to you on October 3rd. Welcome to October, everybody. I can't believe the year is gone. And you know what? We started this podcast, if you can believe this. I don't think I can believe it. We started the podcast, like, what? I think back in February? And now we're in October. So
when you sent me the episode 57, it made it, like, real for me, because I follow along with the episodes and stuff like that, but it's weird because I remember episode 12 and episode 6, and I was like, wow, I can't put 57. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. So crazy to me too. Like, really, it's been a blast. So, but without, further distraction on the matter, real quick, today's episode of the Concealed Carry Podcast is brought to you by USA Firearm Training's Instructor Network. I'll give you more details on that later. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. And so before we get into the news stories, we got a training tip, and today's training tip is really brought to you by Mr. Matthew Marister. We were talking before we started the show. I'm like, hey, dude, like, you got anything, in that big old brain of yours, training tip wise? And after bouncing a few things around, Matthew, you brought up something I think that's really good, and it's a concept of managing recoil. And, we've probably touched on this maybe a little here and there throughout the 57 episodes that we've done now, but I don't think we've really, addressed it head on. Maybe we could do, even a whole episode just about, tips and tricks and ways to manage recoil and proper technique, as far as your grip and everything, and even stance. Like, I don't think people understand sometimes how critical stance even is where it comes to managing recoil,
Right.
A lot of it is grip, but a lot of it is also stance. So anyway, this is something I'm a little bit passionate about, but I don't want to get way off in the weeds because it is meant to just be a simple training tip. Managing recoil. Tell us a little bit, Matthew. You were describing it a little bit for me, and I thought it was really great. Some of the things you've been doing recently with participants in your classes that you think would help them learn managing recoil.
Yeah, so for managing recoil, obviously it's super important. Not so much when you're, plinking or slow firing. You can have any type of grip and two-handed and shoot well. But when you actually start training for self-defense, which most of the listeners, if you're carrying concealed and things like that, You have that self-defense mindset. So managing recoil is really critical in getting multiple shots on an attacker in a short period of time. And the only way you're going to be able to get multiple shots on that attacker is by managing your recoil. If you don't, the gun inherently, when you fire it, is going to have recoil. So you can't eliminate it, but you have to do things that you can manage the recoil so that gun stays on the target and doesn't come off the target, and you have to wait till it comes back on or force it back on. So one of the tips or one of the drills that I started doing a couple months ago in my concealed carry classes is kind of it's called a bunch of different things, but you might have heard it as a controllability drill, which I have them shoot at, it's at 9 feet or 3 yards at a combat effective target. So I use like an 8-inch circle or, you know, a 8x10 piece of paper fold in half, something like that, where your upper chest area. And the drill is, like I said, three yards, 9 feet. And you fire three shots at that distance at your quickest time, and they all have to hit the target. They all have to be on the target for you to complete the drill. And if you get a timer, I use one that's free. It's an app, just Shot Timer. And it gives me a total time, a split time, and a first shot time. And then by looking at that, you really want to key in on as far as managing recoil, key in on that split time, which is the time in between shots. And if you get a very high split time, that can definitely be an indication that you're not doing a good job of managing that recoil and you're having to fight that gun back on the target. So, the only way you're going to be able to put a high volume of shots on a target in a short period of time, we're talking like, second and a half, three shots, second and a half, or, around a second, is by managing recoil. Because if that gun comes off target, that's time wasted trying to get it back on target. So, I think that's a huge, huge thing that you need to focus on as far as defensive shooting.
Good stuff there. Really good tips. And I like, as you described the drill you've been running your students through. And you actually mentioned this before we began recording this episode today. You said that this is a real eye opener for those that show up to class and they're the old school teacup or hand or palm of their support hand on the bottom of the shooting grip, right? Instead of how we teach it today. And so have you actually had students then that have, gone through this drill with you and they shoot like that, and they're just, when you work with them, they see a big change in their times?
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. And it's hard because, changing somebody's grip that's been shooting, and a lot of these guys that shoot teacup or something, one of these other grips, they're mostly, not all the time, but a lot of the old timers that were taught back in the day, and they've been shooting that way for a long, long time. And when you tell them, okay, hold up, I want to change your grip, and it feels funky to them. It is, you're changing something that they've been doing their whole life, and you tell them, trust me, this is going to help you. And at first there's that learning curve where they're not shooting as well. And it's hard for them to buy into, why should I change my grip? And when I tell them, we're going to shoot some slow fire, and they shoot with the teacup grip, say, and they're in the target, and they're happy. They got a good shot group and they're happy with their shot group. And I say, okay, now we're going to run this drill, and they shoot, and they're to shoot, I ask them, hey, how long do you think it should take you to shoot a target at 9 feet or 3 yards, three shots? And they're like, oh, I can get it, 2 seconds or 1 second, something like that. That's their realistic, idea. And then I put them through the drill, and for them to get all shots on target, it's like 8-9 seconds. And they're like, holy cow, I don't understand. Like, I can't shoot any quicker. And it's not that you have to physically squeeze the trigger any quicker. You just have to grip the gun differently. You have to position your body differently so you can manage the recoil. And that way, you can get those shots on target. And once they start buying into it and they see, wow, my time went from, to get three shots on target, went from 8 or 9 seconds to 2 seconds. They're like, okay, now I understand. And it clicks for them. And they're like, wow, you know, it, so I never wanted to do the timing thing because I didn't want people to get wrapped up around, well, I got to get a certain time to be effective. But for that, it's a huge eye opener when they see, like, when they actually see the numbers, it clicks for them. So that's why I started doing it. It got really good feedback in the classes when I started doing it. And now I do it, you know, in all my classes, and it's really, it's received well by the students.
Mm, good stuff. You know, so I'm just going to throw in my own little bit here. Love that drill. You know, people, you know, go try that. If you got a shot timer, you know, definitely, you know, check your times and see what, you know, adjusting your grip, adjusting your stance and other things, you know, will do as far as managing your recoil. I've probably preached on this before, so I'm going to preach on it again in case people have missed it. So while, you know, today we teach this, you know, current grip style of having the support hand really wrapped around the shooting hand, you know, all four fingers, none of this finger on the front of the trigger guard or anything like that. No, that doesn't help you manage recoil any better. You know, wrap your four fingers of the support hand around your shooting hand. It's not a difficult concept, you know, and you've got all this empty space on the grip. On the, if you're a right-handed shooter, on the left side of the grip, you got all this empty space. The base of your palm of your support hand should fill in that empty space. And so if you'll start right there and just wrap the four fingers around, great, you know. And then, you know, more and more we're hearing this talk about, and I've been teaching this for some time now, and doing it for several years, where, you know, a lot of competition shooters will say, you know, grip the gun with your shooting hand. You know, if you think of the total power that you're exerting on the grip of the gun from both hands as equaling 100%, you want like 20 to maybe 30% of that gripping strength being from your shooting hand, and 70 to 80% being from your support hand. So in other words, you're squeezing tighter with your support hand than you are with your shooting hand. And in case it's not clear to you as to why we're talking about that, it has to do with the, you know, when you're squeezing harder with your shooting hand, it has an impact on your trigger finger. And so we want to, as much as possible, isolate the trigger finger, allow it to do its job smoothly. And it's harder to do that when we're squeezing everything. I think you wanted to jump in there, Matthew.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And when you're talking about the percentage thing, it's a huge, you know, I ask people in the classes, I say, if you've ever shot one-handed with your firearm, right? You take your strong hand, you shoot, or you shoot two-handed, you do well, you take your weak hand off or your non-dominant hand, however you want to call it, and you shoot, and it's much harder. It's you know, it's not 20% harder. It's 50, 60, 70% harder to manage the recoil. So if that offhand or non-dominant hand wasn't important in that grip, and it wasn't a huge factor in you being able to manage recoil and keep the gun under control, then it wouldn't really be that much more difficult to shoot one-handed or two-handed, you know. But that offhand, yeah, if you're a right-handed shooter, your left hand is huge in managing that recoil. So, you know, if you're not using it properly, if you're just, you know, teacupping, or you're not really gripping it properly or effectively or getting the best, most out of it, you're missing out on, you know, a huge, huge part of your grip, which, you know, is a huge part of managing recoil.
Yeah. So then the other thing that I preach on is just stance. And the only thing I'm going to say on that is keep your weight forward. Be on the balls of your feet, not on the heels. Don't even hardly be on the heels of your feet at all. Be on the balls of your feet. Action stance, you know, like you're playing basketball or football or, you know, any sport, you know, you're on the tips of your feet, not on the, you know, the ball or the rear of your feet, the heel of your feet. You want to be like ready for action, but it has a really important application in shooting. And when you have your weight forward, your whole body will absorb the recoil better. as opposed to when you're, you know, there's this common stance we see from really a lot of amateur shooters, but I even see it occasionally from more experienced ones that they just have gotten lazy and they stand upright, you know, and actually kind of almost lean back slightly. Mm-hmm. And you know what I'm talking about, right? You've seen it.
Oh, yeah. I've actually taken pictures of students who I keep telling them, hey, you need to lean forward. You're actually leaning back. And they're like, oh, no. And I've taken pictures while they're shooting to show them, hey, this is what you actually look like. And they're like, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm actually leaning backwards. It's like a brisk wind is blowing them backwards. It's
right.
Like
right. Yeah. And when you do that, there's nowhere for the recoil to go except, you know, it translates to more muzzle rise or flip in the gun and the hands because it has to. Like, you can't yourself physically, your body can't move any more backward because you would fall over. And that's not a good, you know, stance from either a accuracy or training, you know, or shooting perspective. But it's also not a good idea from a defensive, you know, position. We want to be, I mean, yes, we are always on the defensive as concealed carriers. But when it comes time to actually have to deal out deadly force and, you know, in a justified scenario, you should actually be taking an aggressive stance.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yep.
Anyway, enough about that. Let's get into the news, shall we?
Awesome.
Okay. First up, coming to us from WND.com, a website, I'll be honest, I'm not that familiar with. We have this story. It's the Cascade Mall shooter in custody. So many of our listeners have brought, you know, are familiar with this incident that happened. Last weekend, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And this was in Burlington, Washington, state of Washington, in the Cascade Mall. So we have a shooter, a native of Turkey. I'm not exactly sure. I don't know. Maybe you could tell me if you've heard more as far as like his motives, whether it was, you know, anything religious or racial.
I haven't heard anything about it. I mean, normally that stuff comes out pretty quickly, but I haven't heard anything. I don't know if it's intentional or not, but I haven't heard any sort of motive or reason why, you know, he went out and did this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess we're in the same boat on that. It's really, you know, quite tragic. I mean, we've got four women that were shot and killed. Let's see, a 16-year-old girl who was a cancer survivor. How horrible would that be for her family? You know, and all the way up to, you know, more elderly women as well. So it doesn't seem like it was so much targeted towards a specific type of person or group of person, and other than women were a little bit more targeted than, because there was one man that was shot as well. So he went into the shopping mall. He had a hunting style rifle. I haven't heard specifically what model or type it was. It was just described as hunting type. Apparently, now this is interesting. Of note, I think that apparently this guy and the shooter, you know, I'm more and more getting on board with this idea of not mentioning these shooters' names, not giving them, you know, any more publicity than is necessary. But this shooter apparently may have been on some sort of rifle team. I don't know if that was in high school or something, because he just graduated high school a year ago, 2015. Which is interesting. So he's not very old. There was a reference apparently on his social media page that he had previously been on a rifle team, apparently. So that's interesting. It certainly would make sense that he's using a hunting type rifle that he can probably shoot pretty well and shoot accurately. And thus, you know, when this sort of thing happens, you're going to see a much greater fatality rate. You know, I mean, if you have a guy with a handgun that goes in somewhere and starts, you know, shooting, yeah, people will die, but, you know, probably there'll be a greater number of wounded as opposed to dead. But when you have somebody go with an AR-15, you know, that fatality rate probably goes up once again. But when you have somebody that goes in with, say, maybe like a 30-06 bolt action rifle, like a lot of the shots that actually hit somebody, you know, do some serious damage. And that's, I'm just discouraged with, you know, all the stuff that's going on lately. But well, what's your take on it, Matthew?
Yeah, well, while I was reading the article, and while you're talking, I was trying to see if I could find anything, and I found a I don't know if it's confirmed, or I saw a couple news little articles that said that the gun, they actually found it, and it was it's a Ruger 10/22.
Oh,
so yeah, so I don't know if it's true or not, but if it were true, that would kind of, it does kind of look like the, you know, a hunting, it is a hunting style rifle,
but a 22. If that's
yeah,
true.
A 22 rifle, and it even said that he had you know, most of those ship with like a 10 round little magazine, mm-hmm. It said that he had like an aftermarket 22 round magazine, which, whether it's 10 rounds or 22, he killed what, 3 people or injured 5, or so.
I think he killed 5.
Or 5 killed, I think killed there was 5,
4
right?
Women and 1 man.
So. You know, so yeah. Whether you're shooting 10 rounds or 22 rounds, certainly 10 rounds would have been sufficient to do damage. But in either event, if you're, you know, that's that 22 caliber rifle, even if it is, if it's a 22 caliber rifle, it's a high velocity projectile at close distance, you know, obviously it's going to do damage. And if that's the case, then, you know, gun assault rifle bans and all that stuff probably wouldn't have been very effective in this case, because it's a, you know, yeah, the rifle you teach your kid to shoot with, right? And like that, yep, you know, nice little easy no recoil rifle. So like I said, I don't know if it's been confirmed, but I saw a couple different articles while you're talking, try to pull it up. So
interesting. Well, of course, as always, and I'm a big advocate of anytime we have any sort of shooting, whether it's officer involved, whether it's civilian, whether it's even a you know, a mass, you know, shooting like such as this, I like to get the facts, and to get facts we have to wait, and people in this day and age just aren't really willing to wait.
No, they're not.
So yeah, we might even talk about that a little bit more later. So let's move on to Utah. Utah is trying to pass constitutional carry yet once again. And so in 2013, the interesting thing was that in 2013, they were fairly narrowly able to get the Utah legislature to vote and pass a constitutional carry measure. And for those that maybe are newer to the podcast or aren't as familiar with some of the terminology in the industry, when we say constitutional carry, it's this concept that, you know, hey, the Constitution, the Second Amendment, gives people the right to keep and carry, keep and bear arms, whether openly or concealed or whatever. And so constitutional carry is this concept of permitless concealed carry. Many states allow open carry, you know, even, especially without a permit, but not as many states allow, you know, people to carry concealed without a permit. And we've talked about, you know, recently we've had states like Idaho. What's the other one that was fairly recently? I can't think of it right off the top of my head, but Idaho, I know, was one of, I think was the most recent one. And I have ties to Idaho, and I remember people talking about it, you know, being this big controversial thing. Like, even gun supporters, you know, in my own family, I remember making comments like, oh, you know, it's going to just turn into like the Wild Wild West. And I'm like, no, it's not. Look at Alaska, Wyoming, Arizona, you know, Vermont, you know, places that for years have had permitless concealed carry, and, you know, there hasn't been anything crazy that's happened as a result of it. So anyway, Utah attempted to pass this through, and actually did pass it through legislature in 2013, but the governor, Republican governor, vetoed it. That was Governor Herbert. Wow. Now they're going for it again. Utah wants to pass constitutional carry. They're going to try again. I suspect that they will probably be able to get it through the legislature again. I think there's a good chance for this, especially, and there's been a move recently in recent years. More and more states have been doing this. I mean, Idaho, just to Utah's north, just most recently did this. And it's been a number of months now that that's been the law of the land. And, you know, it's not turning into, you know, the OK Corral. So,
right.
I think this is why you start to see Utahns that are like, hey, we want in on this too. And I was just going to throw out here the governor's reason for vetoing the law back in 2013. He said that Utah's permitting system has been in place for decades and in its current form for more than 15 years. In that time, it has become a national model, which is true. I mean, everybody, well, most everybody, especially in the concealed carry world, are familiar with Utah permits for concealed carry because a Utah permit you're able to apply for and obtain as a non-resident of Utah even. I have one. I'm a resident of Colorado, but I have a Utah permit. One of the big reasons for that is because it enables me to carry in a couple of additional states that I cannot with my Colorado permit. A big one for me is Nevada because I go there a couple times a year and I love being able to carry concealed in Nevada using, you know, my Utah concealed handgun permit. So Utah has been a model. It is very popular. It's been very successful for them. I suspect it's, you know, brought in a little money for the state over the years. And so I get that. And guess what? They could have constitutional carry and they could still have their national model permitting system. Because you know what?
Yeah.
You don't want to get rid of your permits even when you have a state that passes constitutional carry. And why is that, Matthew?
Well, the reciprocity agreements and things like that are very important.
Exactly.
So that's going to be a huge thing. And that's what people kind of overlook with the constitutional carry is that you're still going to probably want to get your permit because if you travel outside of that state and, you know, you don't have a permit, you have no reciprocity in any of those other states.
Yep. That's exactly it. And so just to suggest that, you know, for some reason, having constitutional carry would, you know, take away anything from your already existing permit, I think is ridiculous. I mean, are you going to have those people that are like, cool, great, I don't need to go get a permit now, I'm just going to carry concealed, you know, I don't leave the state all that often? Yeah, there's going to be some of those people. That's true. But, you know, you're not going to suddenly, like I say, take anything away from your permitting system or process or laws just because you passed constitutional carry. Because I still believe that most gun owners, for one thing, want to have that the reciprocity. And two, I think most gun owners are also, you know, they err on the side of being more responsible than many of your average citizens. Because I understand the great responsibility that comes with owning and keeping and having guns and carrying them, especially for self-defense. And so, which is also why, you know, some people might find it crazy that I, as a firearms instructor, I am an advocate of constitutional carry. That's just me politically. Like, that's where I am. You know, my mindset is as far as the Constitution. And they might think it's crazy that I would suggest that we have something even right here in Colorado that would, you know, take something away from my, you know, ability to make income as an instructor. But I don't believe that would be the case at all, because I think there's still going to be people that are responsible that, you know, come to me for training and go and apply for a state issued or what our state, you know, state level permit. I mean, yeah. So anyway, I say, hey, more power to you, Utah. Go get constitutional carry. Good for you. We'll see. We'll follow this.
Yeah. I real quick while you're talking, it seems to me that, you know, the reasoning given doesn't make sense unless you look at it as an economical point. You know, that's really the only play that would prohibit. I mean, that would want, he didn't say, well, we're afraid of, you know, we've seen this model before in other states and the crime is tripled and quadrupled and it's not a public safety issue. It's nothing like that. It's almost like him coming out and saying it's an economical thing. Our permit process is great. We're making money and we don't want to change it. And to me, that's kind of not the right reason to veto what the people want.
Yep. Now, should be noted that Governor Herbert is running for re-election this year, and he'll probably win. Utah is a very Republican-friendly state. His challenger, his Democratic challenger, is probably not going anywhere. So I suspect that Governor Herbert will see him in office for another 4 years. But he has again promised to veto constitutional carry if it again reaches his desk. So even if it does pass again, it'll probably just die on the governor's desk. So as he is apparently not a fan. Okay, so let's move to Montana, a few hours to the north of Utah. And I mentioned that I was just there a few weeks ago, going through Glacier National Park. I was there in a photography workshop. It was awesome. It was fun.
Saw the photos. Awesome photos.
You've seen like one or two. I got a ton more I gotta work on. But so I stopped off and got a little bite to eat in Missoula, Montana. Actually, I stopped at a Sportsman's Warehouse there too. I realized, oh, there was something that I had forgotten at home. And I stopped there and picked it up, and which happened to be bear spray, by the way. I had some bear spray at home, and I left it, and I got up there, and I'm like, ah, well, I'll stop here at the Sportsman's Warehouse and get some bear spray. So Missoula City Council recently voted 8-4 they passed a citywide ordinance that requires now background checks for all private gun sales. And I find this interesting. You know, I mean, Montana is a beautiful state. Overall, it's a pretty, you know, like it's spread out. There's a lot of laid back, easygoing, freedom loving people. But every once in a while, there's things about Montana that surprise me. And the fact that there would be people, you know, city council people in Missoula, which is one of the larger cities in Montana, that would actually be willing to pass something like this is kind of surprising, but they've done it. Now, some people would think that, well, you know, what's the big deal? Background checks on all, you know, gun sales. So what that looks like, in case it's not clear to anybody, is let's say Matthew, you and I live in Missoula, Montana, and which is a beautiful place, by the way, and you have a gun that I want, all right, and you want to sell it to me. And, you know, anywhere else in Montana, you know, like let's say if we were in Helena even, or Bozeman, or Billings, or Great Falls, or in the boonies, which some of those people would probably think of as still being in the boonies. But anyway, you know, you and I would just meet up, maybe, you know, at your home or wherever, public place, and you'd pull out your gun and you'd, hey, check it out. I'd be like, cool, looks great. You know, here's $500. And we say goodbye to each other and everybody's happy. Now, I have sold guns to people privately in the past. It's been a while since I can't do it legally anymore now here in Colorado. You know, I felt like I should be responsible a little bit. And a lot of times I would say, hey, do you have a concealed handgun permit? And they'd be like, oh, yeah. You know, because a lot of gun-loving people have a permit. And, you know, I'd be like, well, can I see it? Yeah, sure. You know, they pull out their permit. Cool. Great. You know, then I was, you know, because what did that mean to me? It meant to me that they're a law-abiding citizen, that they've been background checked, and I didn't feel like they were buying this gun from me, you know, private party sale, nobody knowing about it, you know, just so they could get a gun, you know, on the street to go use in a crime. And so, you know, to an extent, I mean, I was kind of doing my own background check, right? In a lot of those deals. And so is this really all that different? Yeah, well, maybe not, but it just gives another opportunity, and this is what I don't like about it, for government to get into people's lives. Because what this means for us here in Colorado right now is that, you know, when I want to do a gun deal with somebody or they want to do one with me, you know, we got to go to a local dealer. And there's got to be paperwork filled out. Yeah, exactly. And I have to pay a fee to that dealer. And you know what? I support our local dealers. So to an extent, I'm happy to do that. But then when they passed this law in Colorado a number of years ago now, They also passed along with it a law that required dealers to charge a fee to do the background check, and that money goes to the state. And prior to that, the state, you know, didn't charge anything for background checks. Now, some people, I'm sure, would look at that and go, well, you know, hey, the state is using resources for, you know, them to do this background check to, you know, so you can buy and sell guns. And so thus, you know, it's fair, only fair for them to ask for a minimal fee. But you know what? They're the ones that force it on me.
Right. It's a racket.
Exactly. It's a racket. It's exactly what it is. It's like, we passed this law so that we can then force you to do something and you have to pay us for it.
Yeah. And I'm always, whenever there's new legislation, I always look at the intent, like what is yes. the intent of passing this law? And I'm my brain kind of goes, I've never been to Missoula, but I imagine, you know, I don't know how many private gun sales are going on in Missoula. And if it's, you know, translated into a huge black market gun, you know, culture right. in Missoula, Montana. And you know, if you wanted to pass this law in a place where you're saying, hey, every stop the police are coming up on stolen guns and this and that, and we're really trying to curb this by, you know, this will give us a tool to kind of curb that. I think, you know, it might sit better with me, but going out in Missoula, Montana, and saying, yeah, we have a big problem with private party gun sales and we need a I don't see the intent of you know, what the goal is.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm laughing because you're exactly right. Like, this is something I would expect out of Chicago or Denver right. or even maybe Salt Lake City, but Missoula, Montana, like, holy yeah. crap, we have this rash of illegal guns on the streets because we got to do something about it. Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you're a border town or something where you have a bunch of criminal element, but I can't imagine Missoula, Montana. I mean, I'm speaking out of ignorance and I probably shouldn't, but I don't know the crime rate in Missoula, Montana, but I imagine it's not anywhere near, you know, Laredo, Texas, or Chicago, or Dallas, you know, like these cities that have a big problem with, you know, a large criminal element. Yep. So I don't know. I don't know what the intent, you know, it might've been, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm hearing you, buddy. Missoula is just, to give people an idea, it's a little more than 70,000 people. It's the second largest city in Montana, the first biggest city being Billings. And it's home to University of Montana. So, yeah, okay, cool, whatever, you know. The crime rate there is, I can't say I know exactly or for sure, but I've been to Missoula more than once. And I'm willing to suggest that it's not that bad. It's probably about what you would expect for a population 70,000 city in the West, which is not that bad. So it's interesting to me. Now, here's part of the focus of the article. If you click on the link in the show notes, the title of this news story was Missoula Police to Enforce New Gun Ordinance Based Upon Complaints. So basically, the police department, I feel like, you know, when we pass laws like this, we almost force our law enforcement officers and departments to do this because these are very difficult to enforce laws. I mean, Matthew, honestly, if you and I know each other really well, we're best friends, and you really want to sell that gun to me, we get together in the privacy of one of our homes, and I hand you a little cash, and you hand me a gun, and nobody will ever know.
Right.
Right? Like, how does a law enforcement agency, you know, enforce or prosecute this?
Right. Unless you're sneaking up on somebody in the parking lot or somebody calls and says, hey, I see two guys with a gun, and you go out there and then, you know, through the investigation, they're like, hey, we're selling the gun. But I mean, is this, I guess it would just be jurisdictional as far as inside the city limits. So if you go outside the city limits, then, you know, would you be, I guess you'd be good to go to make a private party transfer. it's kind of one of those things where it's like, you know, if I cross the street and now I'm not supposedly or, you know, in the city's jurisdiction, now somehow by me making this private party sale, I'm safe. You know, the community is safe. But if I cross and do it on the other side of the street, the community is at risk. And I don't see the good, you know, the community well-being out of this. Yep. I just don't see it. I mean, I guess there's people out there that do, or it wouldn't have passed, or there wouldn't have been complaints. So I guess there are.
You know, that's what the Missoula Police Department is basically saying is like they're basically conceding we can't really enforce this. So when somebody complains to us that they think somebody broke the law in the matter, then we'll go check it out.
Right.
That sounds like really great policy to me. Really good law.
Well, it's always been with these controversial laws that happen like that, it's always put the police in the predicament of, you know, making the decision so we can, you're kind of, you know, if you do make the arrest or you do this, then, you know, the police are, you know, taking away the rights. And if you don't, then the police aren't upholding the law and they're not enforcing the law. And it's like, oh, like, I love the politicians when they do that and they give this arbitrary law. Hey, just let the police deal with it. And it's like, it's one of those, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't type situations for the police officers out there. Yep. So.
Well, let's move on to California now. In California, we've talked about the last few news episodes in particular about this veto Gunmageddon petition going on. And honestly, I mean, we were pushing for this. We were encouraging you, listeners in California, to go and make sure you sign this petition because it was honestly, it was like David versus Goliath because they needed at least minimum 365 signatures on this petition. And they were shooting to get over 400,000, you know, because you always got to have a buffer. You don't want to go through all this effort and then find out that, you know, some of the signatures get thrown out because somebody didn't follow policy or whatever. And then you're stuck with a petition that doesn't move forward. And so, unfortunately, California, there were several different petitions. That's the thing here, because there was a couple of different petitions against some of the specific laws that were passed recently. So, for instance, the petition to try to repeal SB 1446, which was the law dealing with magazines to stop grandfathering magazines greater than 10-round capacity. That one only got 117,000 signatures. And the law that does away with bullet buttons, and that's where, you know, you're able to have the higher capacity magazines in your AR-15 in California, provided it meets some other criteria, but especially that, like, it has to use a special bullet button, which means you can't just, like, easily hit the mag release, dump the mag out, you know, stick a new one in. And so they've actually said that now those are no longer acceptable. And so there was 133,000 signatures on that petition. The point is, we weren't even close to getting enough signatures to get these recalls or repeals on the ballot. And I'm sorry. Like, I'm really sorry and sad about that. But I said it was like David versus Goliath because they had 6 weeks to get 400,000+ signatures. And that's really challenging. That's really, really hard. I kind of am not surprised by this. I was hopeful because I'd like to think that out of, you know, 20 some odd or 30, is it 30 million now? I don't know. There's a lot of people that live in California. I kind of was hoping there would be enough people that would be motivated enough to go out. And a lot of these petitions were available in your local gun shops and things where you could go and sign. I guess you just weren't motivated enough, some of you. kind of a bummer.
It's unfortunate. I mean, voter apathy is alive and well in, presidential elections and things like this. So, you know, I think that coupled with the crazy time constraint, it was definitely, like you said, David and Goliath type thing. And it's unfortunate. I hate to use the phrase, but you get the government that you deserve.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I've heard that a bunch of times and you know, if you're not plugged into to political stuff, and trust me, I hate politics so much, but if you're not plugged into what's going on politically, you know, you have the ability to be, to have a political environment that you might not favor. So you gotta be engaged.
Yep. You do. And there's a couple other points I'd probably talk to on this story, but because of time, we're going to move along. I really hope Californians, I really sincerely do, because it's a shame what is going on in your state there, with the leadership at the top, your governor, your lieutenant, your crazy lieutenant governor. Such an idiot. Did you see the news story, Matthew? Like he made some comment. I can't remember the Olympian's name. Shoot. She's the Olympic shooter, I think shotgun. She won her sixth Olympic medal. She's been competing for years and is, you know, has really done well for herself. And she, I think she was the first, was she the first medal that was won at the Rio Olympics? Yeah. And so the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, tweeted her something and said something. He made some comment about how, well, you know, like, you know, ammunition that you buy at the gun ranges, you know, to use at the range is exempted from this recent, you know, crazy ridiculous laws we passed. And and she replied back with like, she just totally burned him. It was great. I can't even remember all the details. Well, maybe we'll find that story and put that on our website or something. It was really great. Anyway, he's a crazy lieutenant governor. To your legislature, your state senate, it's a shame what's going on in your state there. I really don't believe that the majority of the state is as far left as it seems, as you would think it is. I think you have some terrible districting as far as votes are concerned. And I think you have a lot of money there that just pours crap loads of money into that state to continually keep it, you know, leaning towards, you know, the side that, gosh, Jacob's not here. So I can bash on Jacob a little bit, you know, but the side that we all know that is against us most of the time on this whole gun control thing. There's just so much money there that, you know, I mean, there's this Safety for All Gun Control Initiative, which is the lieutenant governor's, you know, it's been a big push with him. They have crap loads of money pouring into that campaign, you know? No. And anyway, it's a shame. So my heart goes out to you Californians, and I hope to see us turn the tide there at some point. Let's move to Florida. Florida is doing some good stuff. This is actually some good news on a you know, from a state level. So we're going to the opposite side of the country here. Florida expedites 50,000 CCW permits for veterans and active military. This should put a smile on your face, Matthew, because you're a vet.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, these guys, you and gals, you allow them to carry firearms overseas to protect our freedoms, and you know, at the most difficult situations, and give them training and trust them, and then when they come back home, you disarm them, and it's just, you know, with the the tide swing, you know, we see more attacks on military just for the fact of them being military, and to disarm them, you know, is not right. And you know, this obviously Florida wasn't disarming them, but to expedite it, to say, hey, you know what, we're gonna do this for you guys and gals, I think it speaks to the correct mindset, is saying, hey, the more people that are trained with firearms, that are walking the streets, the safer our overall citizenry is. So I think it's the right mindset.
Absolutely agree. And I thank you for your input on that, and because I respect your input. And I also thank you, Matthew, like many of our other veterans and active military, for your service. So let's continue moving forward, though. This is one I've been looking forward to getting to, because I find this very interesting. Title is, and this is from nj.com, newjersey.com. Anti-gun control video project gets high school student suspended. So the story here goes that you have this, I think he was a junior, no, he's a senior. He's a senior in high school. This kid, he needed to work on a project for a, it was a junior college readiness class. He apparently had gone to his teacher and asked for, you know, the initial okay on the, his project. He was going to produce a video that, and his whole premise was, you know, anti-gun control. He was going to use examples of people that had used guns to defend themselves from home invaders, and stuff like that. Okay, so apparently he's working on this project and he leaves the thumb drive with his files on it in a school computer, and somebody else finds it. And they see, you know, the video or whatever that he's working on, and they alert the school administration. And next thing he knows, this student is suspended because he's apparently working on this anti, you know, gun control project and or video. Now, there's two stories, two links in the show notes. I've posted another one from Fox News, has some more details. And the school, the district superintendent has said that that this student and his mother are making a lot of this up. Okay. It's kind of like, we don't really know who to believe here, but you know, the student and his mom have made it, you know, abundantly clear that, you know, their perspective is that he was suspended because of political motivations by the school. So once again, we may need to have, you know, wait to have things sort out here. But if this is true, Matthew, if he is truly being suspended because he's doing a project where he is countering the idea of gun control, I mean, we all know where probably a good portion of teachers and administrators at school stand on this issue. They would probably say gun control, good, you know, and so obviously this would counter, go against what the narrative that many school administrators and or teachers would you know, prefer to see. Do you think that's what's going on here? That you think that, you know, they disagree with his viewpoint and thus they're punishing him, or, you know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I hope not. The thing that, you know, obviously there's conflicting stories, and I guess we don't know the truth yet, or the whole truth. So, you know, I don't want to jump to conclusions and say it's true or it's not. But it, you know, I would hope that, and I think this kind of goes back to the frightening, or why gun owners are just so on edge. Because, you know, you would hope that you could go to school and have it be a place to learn all different types of ideas and views, and actually learn it and see what you agree with and what you don't, rather than a place where you go and are told, this is the right way to do something, or this is the right way to believe or think. And I would hope that, you know, this kid isn't being punished or isn't being attacked. I mean, you know, simply finding a thumb drive with videos of people defending themselves with firearms, I don't even understand how that would even draw the attention of administrators. I mean, honestly, unless there was something on this that I'm going to shoot up the school, but simply somebody inquiring or you know, researching, you know, gun control, good or bad, and that somehow falls on or hits the radar of police and administrators. I don't know. It's kind of scary to me if that's true, that you can't even, you know, have a thumb drive with an opposing point of view, and now you're viewed as a threat, and without something else on there where you could articulate, hey, this kid is a threat. He's making threatening or, you know, irrational things, but just simply, you know, doing some research and having some videos that show people defending themselves with firearms kind of seems a little bit, you know, knee jerk or a little bit overreacting. But I don't know. I guess we don't know the truth, you know, exactly what's going on there yet.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of truth in what you said. I completely agree and support you and your thoughts. You know, I'm looking at schools, and like, schools should be actually like educating our children, not indoctrinating them, right? My kids, they go to an elementary school that is part of what's called an international baccalaureate program. So an IB school is what they refer to it as. It's a program that has a little different take on education, and some of it could be thought of as being controversial. I've actually been quite happy with the education my kids have been getting so far, but I am always looking for opportunities to be like, you know, that's bull crap, you know, like, but the idea is what they tell us all the time is that they're trying to teach our kids to look at the world around them and ask questions, you know? And like, if that's actually what they're doing, then, oh man, like, I am all for that. Like, we should look at the world around us. We should try to evaluate it as best we can. And one of the ways we evaluate it is by asking sincere, well thought out, you know, pointed questions. You know, is this true? Is that not true? How does this work? And look at all sides of the issue. If this story is true coming out of New Jersey, and it wouldn't necessarily surprise me, by the way, if it's true, then shame, shame, shame on these educators, and shame on much of our, you know, education system in America, because of all of its failings that it does have. Obviously, we know it can get better, but we hear stories all the time. So, I mean, that's why this wouldn't necessarily surprise me. We hear stories all the time about schools and teachers that are indoctrinating kids, which is the complete opposite of what they should be doing. That is not education. That is brainwashing.
No. Yeah. And if you have to pick your teacher based on your you shouldn't have to say, hey, what are your, go to the teacher, hey, what are your political views? Where do you stand on abortion? Where do you stand on these controversial issues? And say, okay, yeah, now I can have my son or daughter taught by you. It should be, I'm sending them to this school so they get a well-rounded view of politics and everything, and if they want to say, you know, lean this way on this issue or that way, that they're not going to be, you know, chastised or shot down in their beliefs. That, you know, teachers, they have to keep that their personal, you know, their personal beliefs out of the instruction. It's not appropriate. It's just not.
Yep. Well, enough said about that. Let's get to our first justified story. And we got three stories today, and these all three we're going to go through probably fairly quickly. Not a lot of storytelling here, probably necessarily. Pretty cut and dry as far as I see some of these. So the first one is in Lubbock, Texas, on September 23rd. So it's, you know, not too long ago. We've got a man who's recovering from a gunshot wound to his leg, and this man is actually the perpetrator of a crime. So he apparently approaches Kedrick Trotty and Christy Trotty, a married couple, and he approaches them in their driveway. Okay, now that's a hint, because, you know, I always look at these stories as far as, you know, what can we learn from this? In a couple episodes, I think it was two episodes ago, we talked about this mother in Walmart. Did you hear that episode, Matthew?
Yeah.
Right? Where she's trying to buckle her child into the car seat. And, you know, it's a very, that's a tough thing, you know, without compromising yourself. It's such a vulnerable position and time. So this guy approaches this married couple in their driveway shortly after they pull in. We all feel, I guarantee you, we all feel reasonably secure and safe in our own driveways. Like, that's just, you know, that's how we live our lives. Exactly. We get in our comfort zones, and like, our home feels secure. It feels safe. Our driveway, we would include in that to an extent. So this man approaches this married couple in their driveway. He's wearing a black ski mask and wielding a handgun. So a pretty obvious threat has presented itself. He threatens the driver, the husband, Kedrick. He demands money and demands that he gets out of the vehicle. That's a scary situation right there.
Right.
Right. Some of these play out, you know, where you give them what they want and they leave you alone. And sometimes people, like there was a carjacking not that long ago right here in Denver, and it didn't go so well for the driver of the vehicle. Okay. Anyway, as he's focused on the driver, the husband, the wife gets a handgun out of the car and was somehow able to hand it to her husband. The husband then fires several shots at the armed suspect, hitting him once in the leg. Ugh, not a very good, you know, ratio there, but hey, we'll take it because it stopped this attack on them and landed this would-be robber and maybe even carjacker in the hospital, and he will be released to jail upon being released from the hospital. So there you go. There's our first justified story. Thoughts, Jake, or not Jacob, Matthew. We obviously do this a lot with Jacob.
I think it's good. And it kind of, something that popped in my head was, you know, I have a lot of couples that come through concealed carry classes, and sometimes I get, you know, the wife or the husband, and they say, well, my wife or husband or my spouse didn't want to come, they don't want to carry or whatever. And I always think, you know, if you're going to have a firearm, it's one of the two are going to be carrying a firearm. It can't hurt, even if they don't want to carry it themselves. It can't hurt, number one, for safety reasons. Number two, for tactical reasons and legal reasons, understanding, like, you know, if this woman would have felt comfortable, and maybe she didn't, never had training, her husband was the only one with training, and that's why she handed the gun over. But what if she wasn't able to get the gun to him, but she had the gun available and, you know, wasn't able to use it because she didn't feel comfortable with it? And always thinking, well, my husband's armed, he'll be okay. You know, there might be an incident where, just like this, the husband can't, you know, gun's probably in the glove box or center console or something, and she had access to it, but he didn't, and he's the trained one. So, you know, for me, I mean, and there's some legal issues as far as, you know, one being licensed and the other one not, and then that person getting out and going in somewhere, and then you getting stopped and you're in the car with, and you don't have a license. But for this situation, you know, I think it's a perfect example of, you know, if your husband or your wife is going to go and get a concealed carry permit, even if you're not going to carry yourself all the time, I think it's a great idea from a bunch of different reasons, but this explaining it perfectly, why it would help to have some training yourself too.
I really appreciate your thoughts on that, because as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about how, you know, in our marriages, in our relationships, like the ideal is that, you know, my wife and I, that we are the best, you know, partnership that we could be, you know, that, you know, one of the whole ideas behind us even being married or being, you know, joined together, even if it's just contractually, you know, via our marriage license with the state, you know, it, the idea is that together, like, we are hopefully better and bigger than, you know, the
individual,
right? You know, like that's the whole idea, you know. And children do better when raised in homes like that. We know that, statistically speaking, you know. So that's the idea. Like, we should be like this really great partnership that is, because we're a partnership. And when we work together, like, we succeed better than we could if we were just on our own. And why would it be any different in a situation like this? This is a situation where the wife was able to help the husband, actually help them, you know, help them both. But she was able to get this gun to her husband, who was able to use it effectively and hope, you know, maybe stop something, you know, really horrible from happening to them. And so a lot of truth in what you said, you know, like, I know there's going to be relationships where one of the partners is not enthused about having anything to do with a gun. If you are one of those, if you know somebody like that, I don't know what the answer is to try to, you know, like, I don't know that you can force anybody to do something they don't want to do. But But, you know, how wonderful it would be to have, you know, a husband and a wife or, you know, a couple be on the same page with each other as far as their, you know, self-defense strategies, particularly as far as, you know, having or carrying or concealing or using firearms. I think it'd be, you know, there's a lot to be said there.
Yeah.
Next story coming to us from guns.com, a story out of Maine, Waterboro, Maine. This happened on September 20th, and is about 12:38 in the morning. You've got a mother. She's obviously sleeping, although she's not really sleeping because her six-year-old daughter was having trouble sleeping. So daughter is in bed with mom. And, you know, it's interesting because I have to wonder, you know, the point is, in the story, there's going to be a male intruder. And was he doing something, you know, before he actually ends up going into the home, looking through a window or something that was disturbing this daughter? I don't know. But like the same night that we had our neighbor's vehicles get vandalized, and it, you know, startled us and woke me up. And like, I thought somebody was like, it was so close and so loud through my bedroom window that like, I thought somebody was trying to break into my house. Like the funny thing is that night, one of my daughters couldn't sleep and climbed into bed with us.
Wow.
You know, like wow. I was like, oh, I totally relate to this story. I'm like, something is going on, right? And now every time a child gets up in the middle of the night, like I always like have this thought, and you know, I'm like, is something going on outside, you know? Anyway, so what happens is, so this mother, her name's Kristen Mariner, her six-year-old daughter is in bed with her, and a little while later, she wakes up to a strange man standing over her bed, shining a flashlight in her face. What an idiot. no, I don't know. It turns out, by the way, that this intruder is actually her neighbor, and apparently he suffers a little bit from mental health issues, and she says was obviously intoxicated. It's a bad combination to have mental health issues, right, and be heavily intoxicated. And so, you know, he's probably not really totally aware of, you know, what he's doing, or at least not able to control himself. So he breaks into this house. But what's interesting is the mom jumps up, she faces him, and she says, "I have a gun, and I am not afraid to use it, and you need to leave." When he refuses to leave, she goes and gets her gun and tries to push the guy out of her home. and he basically doesn't do a very good job of leaving. It's only really once deputies show up on the scene and take him into custody that the situation really resolves itself. And I think what's interesting from this story is that she doesn't actually shoot him.
Right.
You know, so many of these stories we share, I mean, and it's interesting because this isn't our justified segment, which usually involves someone using force in a justified manner because they had reason or cause to. So many of these stories involve people that have someone that's, you know, invaded their home. They've come in and they shoot him. And in this situation, she doesn't actually shoot him. And she uses, I think, very good logic because she says, it's paraphrasing her, I assume, but she said she wasn't going to shoot her neighbor, the father of her children's friends, in front of her kids, unless it was absolutely necessary. And she didn't feel that it was. I think she made the right judgment call here. I have to agree. You know, and how horrible would that be to have to be faced with this? And, you know, if you actually had to shoot the father of your children's neighbor's friends, you know, like that would be tough.
Yeah, I think this is an incredible story, and I'm so glad that you found it, because this is incredible, and we kind of can overlook it because she didn't end up actually pulling the trigger. But like, her words should be pretty much in the back of everybody's mind who potentially would use force. And I didn't want to shoot, you know, this person unless it was absolutely necessary, and I didn't think it was, because, you know, yeah, everybody knows the castle doctrine and things like that, and we talk about that, and this guy was, you know, he absolutely, you know, under different circumstances with a different mindset of that homeowner, possibly shot in that home. And it might have been a justified shooting based on that homeowner's, you know, belief that he was going to harm, you know, or he was there to harm them. But she showed incredible restraint in saying, you know what, I didn't feel like it was absolutely necessary. He was a threat, but was he an immediate threat, or was it, you know, a threat where I needed to use deadly force to stop it? And she didn't determine it. And I think that that's an incredible amount of restraint and, you know, good judgment in her mind. I mean, you think middle of the night, somebody wakes you up, and to be able to have that clarity and mindset shows that, you know, most gun owners really are, you know, reasonable and will not use deadly force unless it is, you know, absolutely the last resort. And, you know, I think this is just as powerful of a story as, you know, somebody who kicks down a door and they get, you know, they end up shooting the bad guy. I think this is, I love this story. This is awesome. Yeah.
Good analysis there. You're right. That, and I quoted that, you know, it's so, to me, it's empowering, really, to hear someone like this say that she wasn't going to shoot this person unless it was absolutely necessary. That shows a lot of restraint and self-control. And that to me is empowering. We are responsible for whatever follows, you know, choices and actions that we make. And you know what? If she had shot this guy, which you're right, she probably could have, like, under the law, probably done so and not faced charges. But what would she be left with? She'd be left with the knowledge that, oh, I shot and killed my, you know, my children's, you know, next door friend's father. I had to do it in front of my kids. My kids are now terrorized, and you know, they'll never get that image out of their mind for the rest of their life. There's a lot of consequences that follow something like that. Now, if she had to do it, then she should have done it, right? But she felt like she didn't have to, and she didn't, and she's better because of that.
Yeah. That article I wrote a long time, the moral component, that's a huge thing for me, is like that, you know, the aftermath of the shooting, you know, it might be justified, it might be legal, but you have to live with that. And you know, even if it's justified and your kids are sitting right there too, you know, they have to live with that. And if it's not absolutely necessary, you know, and this woman determined that. And I think this is super powerful story. And if you look at the guy, he doesn't look like a, you know, he's there to sell Girl Scout cookies or anything in the article. He doesn't look like someone you'd want to wake up to in the middle of the night hovering over your bed and your six-year-old daughter. But
yep. Final justified story. Las Vegas. Robber shot in attempted holdup near Nellis Air Force Base. So this is an interesting story. And the story that is in the show notes doesn't probably quite give you all the details. I did find a few more details on another story. But basically what you have happened here is a meetup. You have a guy that agreed to meet a woman whom he met online, I believe on Craigslist. This would be a meeting that the type of meeting.
A lot of bad stories start with this.
you know what I'm referring to here, okay? They're meeting to get together, and when the woman shows up, she doesn't show up alone. She shows up with another man, and this other man has, I believe, a weapon, and he tries to rob this unsuspecting individual that was, you know, trying to meet the woman. So what the victim does is he's actually carrying a gun concealed. He draws, he fires. He doesn't kill the would-be robber, but you know, instead sends him to the hospital. Apparently, police have said that the armed robbery victim is not expected to face charges. Does this come as a surprise to anybody? Like, that, you know, like, is this this is not that crazy that you would think, okay, we have a Craigslist meeting, you know, a guy looking for a cute girl wants to get together with her for you know what, really, you know, this is a gal that has a guy, it's probably her boyfriend, you know, and they're using this as a phishing attempt to, you know, hook this guy and, you know, get him in a vulnerable, compromised situation so they can rob him. Yeah. No surprise here.
Exactly.
So he kind of, in my opinion, brought it on himself to an extent. But at least he was prepared.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, all of our listeners probably are not going to have to face this because they probably aren't going to Craigslist to hook up with people. So we probably won't have this scenario come up with any of our listeners. But yeah, I mean, obviously, I think this goes to, like, know your surroundings, know what you're getting into, where you are, and don't put yourself at any, you know, added risk. I mean, this is a risky thing to do by itself. So, I mean, I don't know. It's just, I wouldn't, you know, it's just,
yep.
You put yourself in some bad situation. The couple that's coming home that gets robbed in their driveway, yeah, you can't help that. But this, I mean, you kind of bringing a lot of that on yourself.
Yeah, and we live in an interesting time too, right? With technology, the internet, with social media, websites like Tinder. And I was just curious. I'm going to just, you know, like this doesn't surprise us coming from Craigslist. But then I'm like, what about Tinder? Has there been like attacks on people that have tried to hook up on Tinder? And I do a quick Google search, Tinder attack, and boom, like story after story after story. I mean, we just live in a unique time as far as the way people are meeting and finding people, including sexual partners. And, you know, just this type of stuff never happened or would have happened quite in the same way, you know, even just 10 years ago. But now we've got the power of the internet and social media. Right. So yeah, be wise in your interactions on social media, people. So saving the best for last. I don't know if you'd actually call this the best, but I think, it, you know, Matthew, with your background, I think you bring a special perspective to this. So recently, it's been well, you know, documented. It's been all over the media. You know, just shortly after the riots and protesting in North Carolina and elsewhere, we've got now the same thing going on in El Cajon in California. El Cajon being, you know, near San Diego. Been to San Diego. Love San Diego. Beautiful. Matthew, you've been there as well. I know. So it's a nice place. But, you know, here we have an individual that is shot. He's unarmed, but he does something to suggest that he is not, and he gets himself shot and killed. And people are upset about it. What's going on here, Matthew?
Yeah, well, if you don't know where El Cajon is, it's just outside of San Diego. I used to be a police officer out there in El Cajon. And it's a city 110,000 crammed into about 9 square miles, so pretty densely populated, lots of hotels and apartments and things like that, liquor stores but what ends up happening is you know, disturbed person running in on traffic call. Police officers show up. The guy has his hands in his pockets, or at least one hand in his pocket. Officer approaches him, telling him to get his hands out of his pocket. Guy's pacing back and forth and ends up, you know, kind of coming to a little spot where he can no longer retreat. And takes a shooting stance at the officer, pulls out one of those vaping devices, which has like a metal barrel on it.
We're talking about the type. It's like got a rectangular body. They've showed an image. The police department has. It's got a black rectangular shaped body, then attached off center. Okay, so you know, kind of like in an L shape. You got this black rectangular body with this nickel plated, you know, cylindrical, you know, barrel shaped, you know, protrusion, which is where you would, you know, stick in your mouth and inhale. It's one of those type of vaping devices. So,
right. Yeah. So, I mean, definitely can look like a gun. probably not if you're holding it in your mouth, you know, in your hand, vape, using it, you know, to inhale the vapors or whatever. But when you take a shooting stance and pull it out and point it like a gun at the officer, you know, it's perceived as a threat. The officer shot, and unfortunately, the person ended up dying. Yep. But there were a lot of riots right away and a lot of problems saying, you know, another unarmed African-American was shot by police, and it was quickly quickly in the media and stuff. So, you know, the problem was I think, in knowing that the department and everything wanted to do the best thing, and they released a still image, even while the investigation is ongoing, a still image of the second as the officer was shooting, showing that, you know, the person, because there was a lot of people going on saying his hands were up, he was kneeling, his hands were up in the air, he didn't do anything, the cop just walked up and shot him. And that was what was going on. There were a lot of protests gathering on that narrative. So they released that to say, hey, you know, the benefit of the, you know, for the safety of the community, because, you know, it's getting more violent. So they released that image to say, hey, no, that is a false narrative. This is what happened. Well, apparently the family was outraged that they released that video or that picture. Everybody was saying to demand the release of any video of it. So the next day they released the video that they had. I mean, basically showing the video, and that's kind of unprecedented. You know, normally these things aren't released right away while the investigation's still going, but the protests were getting more violent. So the chief, working with the district attorney, said, hey, you know what? We need to stop, you know, this from escalating. They released the video, which clearly, you know, if you watch it, you can see, you know, how it plays out. But I think it's one of those things where, you know, people jump to conclusions really quickly. But as a former police officer, I know you're a police officer and you go through the training. I mean, officers handle the approach to calls differently, but no officer is, you know, every officer is going to perceive somebody taking a shooting stance, pulling something out of their pocket and pointing it at them like a gun as a threat. I mean, there's just no two ways around it.
And, well, it happens so fast, right? I mean, your perception, you know, your perception as whether you're an officer or anybody else for that matter, your perception is like you don't know what's going on with this individual. They're acting a little off. Maybe they're even acting threatening in some way with their words or their actions. And all of a sudden, you know, their hands come out of their pockets really fast. Like, you know, your perception is, holy crap, this person's going to kill me. You know, like, what else can you think? I mean, just imagine. All right, so some people, I'm sure, would suggest that, well, the officer maybe should have waited a little longer and actually identified what it was that was in his hands. Okay. Is that really reasonable, though? No, because if that actually was a gun in his hand, you're dead by that point.
Exactly.
Right?
And that's what I just think it comes from a lack of reality in, you know, in how quickly things, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I'll be able to tell the difference between an airsoft gun and a real gun, or I'll be able to do this, or I'll be able to do that. And the reality is that you don't have the time. You just, by the time, I mean, there's physiological things that it takes, you know, close to a half a second for you to even perceive a threat, you know, before you can start moving. It's that old trick where the bar trick where you're holding the dollar, you'll let go of the dollar and the person has to close their hand and catch the dollar and they can't do it. I mean, there's physiological things. So I think that, you know, the public kind of has an unrealistic idea of what police officers are able to they don't realize that they're human beings. They're constrained by the laws of, you know, human physiological ability, and being able to perceive a silver barrel of a vape device versus a silver barrel of a gun in less than a second. at, you know, 5 feet, it's yeah. impossible.
I mean, and you saw yeah. the barrel on the on this, you know, the inhaler portion of this vape device. It's nickel plated or silver in color. You see that come out of a pocket, the light of the sun or whatever catches that. Like, I guarantee you, this officer thought he was dying in the next second. I mean, you're going to think gun, no matter, you know? Like, there's, it just, it boggles my mind how everybody is in the streets, you know, just rioting and going crazy over this. How do they not see that? I don't know, but it's clear to me that we as a society could do a better job on the whole of educating our citizenry as to, you know, what these situations are really like, what reality actually is.
Yeah, I think, you know, you see the videos on Facebook and that where the community leaders go through, you know, a mock sheriff's department training. They always, every single time you watch these videos of regular citizens or news reporters go through these scenarios that police put them through, they always, every single time, come away with the, you know, saying, wow, I cannot believe how difficult of a decision that is, how difficult of, you know, and officers get it right so many times. And yeah, they get it wrong. Sometimes they get it wrong and they should be prosecuted if they do something grossly negligent and purposefully, you know, illegal or something like that. But they get it right so many times, and it's really hard to kind of, you know, understand where people, you know, I get it. If police officers are out there just randomly walking up to people and shooting them, I'd be the first one out there standing with you saying, you know, we need to reform this. But to do it within the first 10 minutes of an incident and put out a false yeah. narrative, it's just, it's one of those things. And it kind of hit home to me because, you know, I knew all the officers. I knew what was going on. I knew the city. I know the people. And it's like, for me, it kind of hit home to say, you know what, this could happen to anywhere. This could happen to any officer, any person. And you have to realize as a civilian too, you're going to be scrutinized when you end up using force too. And, you know, it's just, it's unfortunate that we have that unrealistic expectation. I hope people moving forward, you know, really, really wait till facts come out before, you know, they riot and protest and do all these things and really get the facts and understand, put yourself in these situations. You know, yes, the person had the call, you know, the person, the caller said he wasn't armed, but, you know, truthfully, you go on calls, you don't know what that person knows or truthfully knows. I've gone on calls where they say the person isn't armed and they are actually armed, or they are armed, you know, and you get there and they don't, and they're like, no, I don't have a gun. I don't have a knife. You know, they're crazy. The person who called is crazy. Yeah. I don't have that. And it, you know, so you take it with a grain of salt, but you don't bet your life as an officer on the veracity of the caller and saying, well, if they said he couldn't possibly, he wasn't armed, so he can't possibly, this object that he's pointing at me that looks like a gun can't possibly be a gun. It's just, it's unfortunate. It's some, you know, it's an unfortunate situation nobody wants to be in, but, at the end of the day, you know, it's just, we can't be simulating an attack on an officer and not expect that that reaction. It's just not going to happen.
Yep. But, you know, it's tough. We have a really trying time, I think, in the near future for this country. It's clear that even when the truth is presented, that it is not heard by the other side. And I'm like you, Matthew, in that I will be the first to call out an officer that makes the wrong call, that does the wrong thing. If he's a bad cop, yeah, he should be called out. And you said something that I think is so such an important statement that I wish more people, you know, had any faith in. And that is the statement you said that so often officers do get it right in these type of cases. And it is remarkable that, you know, it is the exception rather than the rule that when deadly force is used, when an officer is involved in a shooting, it's exceptionally rare that they are, you know, completely wrong in, you know, what in their actions for the situation, which is why we rarely see prosecutions, or, you know, especially rarely see convictions of officers that are, you know, that shoot somebody. Because when you look at the evidence, and when you look at, you know, and this is such a key thing, when you put the case, when you lay it out in front of a jury and you give them all the facts, and not all the facts are ever released to the public, especially before a trial. And you give them the perception, you know, of the officer. Like, it's so, I think, easy in a lot of situations for a jury to look at and go, gosh, I would do the same thing. Like, exactly. If I was in this guy's shoes, I would do the same thing. And so, you know, a conviction is so rare. Now, I'm not saying there's definitely been times I think that officers have kind of gotten off, that maybe they could have done things differently. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe Absolutely. They didn't, you know, blatantly Absolutely. Break the law, but maybe they could, you know, like, yeah, there's situations like that too. But is it the exception or the norm? No, it's the exception, I think, so often. But you have media, and especially these protesters, that would have you believe that this is the norm, that it's prevalent, that it is everywhere, that it is pervasive, that cops are just out to get people, especially black people. And it's far from the truth. But we're beating on a dead horse now at this point. I know most of our listeners, I'm sure, agree with this or see it a lot this way. I know we have a lot of veterans that listen to the podcast. I know we have law enforcement listen to the podcast. You already get what we're saying. But I thought it would be good to have your perspective, Matthew, since, one, you've been a cop, and especially you've been a cop in El Cajon. Yeah. I think you told me you served in El Cajon PD for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a diverse city, but you know, it's a good city. It's a very, very active, very busy city. But yeah, I just wanted to, you know, the last thing I want to say about, you know, uses of force and things like that. And, if you're, for the listeners, look up court case Graham versus Connor, and that explains what reasonableness is. And I kind of bring this up in my concealed carry classes too. And it's always going to be reasonableness. Is it reasonable? So look up that court case, and then it'll give you an understanding of, you know, is this reasonable? Is the use of force reasonable? And it'll help you guys even in your own concealed carry when you end up, you know, contemplating using force, and is it right yep. or wrong?
Yeah, this really is the standard, especially where applies to law enforcement use of force, right? In whether they're making an arrest or even in the use of deadly force. So it's a very well-known case. In fact, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to post in the show notes here. The first thing here is just a Wikipedia link, which, you know, gives you a quick overview for our listeners, and then I'll have another thing posted here momentarily. So when this goes out, you'll see this in the show notes. So if you want to research that, by all means, please do. This is the objective reasonableness. This was the case that, you know, a lot of the procedures that cops follow nowadays goes back to this. So, man, what a fantastic episode, Matthew. I appreciate your time today doing this. Like, it's been eye-opening for me in some regards. It's been fun having you back on too, because it's just been too long.
I love it, man. I love it.
So, today's episode of the Concealed Carry Podcast is brought to you by the USA Firearm Training Instructor Network. In 17 states across the nation, USA Firearm Training has classes for anyone interested in procuring their concealed carry permit or even getting trained in other areas. I know, Matthew, I think you teach a lot of concealed carry-oriented classes, but I think you teach some more advanced type stuff too, don't you?
Right. Yeah, I do some advanced, like defensive handgun classes too.
Yep, yep. And you're based in Columbus, Ohio. We have another instructor too in Cincinnati. He's been on the podcast with us, Rob Beckman. And I know he does a lot of really cool and interesting courses as well. So my point is, though, these classes are taught by highly trained individuals that each get the USA Firearm Training Seal of Approval. If you are interested in looking more in-depthly into the courses we offer and whether your state currently has a USA Firearm Training instructor in it, you can contact us at usafirearmtraining.com/contact. But also on our website, we used to have something kind of similar, but I don't think it ever really worked. But we've got a new tool available, and I'll post the link in the show notes as well, where you can go there and you can select your state of choice. It'll give you a map of the U.S., show you the states that we have instructors in currently, and you can click on the state that's, you know, that you're in or that is nearest you, and you can very easily find and locate one of our instructors and take a course from them. And they're all fantastic guys. You've heard, you know, a number of them on the podcast now up to this point. So, you know, please check out our instructor network if you haven't already. If we don't have an instructor near you at this time, we hope to soon be able to have somebody near you, because we're working on, you know, actively expanding our instructor network at this time. And in fact, if you are interested in becoming an instructor or a trainer yourself, if you'd like to join our network, if you're already an instructor, we're interested in you. So feel free to visit our page, usafirearmtraining.com/firearm-instructors, with a lot of information there oriented towards prospective instructors in our network. And you can contact us there. So definitely, you know, and we've had a few people do this just recently. We've been talking to some new instructors in Texas, in Florida, and a handful of other places. So, you know, we hope to add more to our network. We are focusing, by the way, as far as looking for instructors, we are focusing right now primarily on states where we already have a presence, because it just makes, you know, more business sense that way. But we won't rule, you know, you out just because you're in a new state. I mean, we are looking to expand into more states as well. So, once again, if you're looking for a class to, you know, from one of our instructors, go to our homepage. I'll have a link to it. It'll take you directly to this page where you can just click on your state and quickly find an instructor. And if you're an instructor looking to join our network, please, you know, go, feel free. We'll have that link as well in the show notes, usafirearmtraining.com/firearm-instructors. Now, on our next episode of the podcast, we'll be talking about training with the OODA loop in mind. Now, some of you, I know some of you listening just went, "What? What did Riley say? OODA loop?" And I know some of you too. This is a very, you know, well-known and understood concept. But I know there's people out there, because I run into it all the time. I'll mention OODA loop and they're like, "What?" And then that is OODA. It's an acronym, okay, essentially. So if you don't know what that is and you're going, "What the heck are they talking about right now?" Believe me, this will blow your mind. Okay, and it's not really a difficult or complex concept, but there's some principles therein. I think, you know, just it, once you start to really think with this in mind, I think will change your world, especially as you look at how you train. This is really big for us in my law enforcement agency, as far as, you know, how we train our officers. You know, we have this in mind, this OODA loop concept, and it will change your world if you're not that familiar with it. And if you are, you know, maybe it'll cause you to revisit some of the things you're doing and how you're doing them, and maybe make some changes or catch some bad habits or whatever that have developed. So, and Matthew, you've agreed to join me again for Wednesday's episode. It'll be episode 58. Absolutely. And you're familiar, wow, with the concept, so I'm looking forward to discussing it with you. In case people are wondering where Jacob is out of town. He's going through some, I guess, training, or I don't know, it's like a conference or a seminar or something. I really don't know. But he's somewhere that I'm not, and hopefully he's having fun wherever he is. And so he'll be maybe back on with us next week, but he has gone this week. So we miss him, but Anyway, we've been actually probably a little bit longer than usual, but you know, a lot of great stuff that I think, you know, Matthew, you've brought to the podcast today. Some excellent discussion. Thanks again for joining us. Do you have any last words for the listeners?
Sorry for being so long-winded. I'll tone it down next week.
Oh, it's not just you, buddy. I'm just as guilty. And I don't think, you know, I don't think I'm hearing anybody complaining. Anyway, so thanks so much for listening. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. We appreciate you all. And so we'll see you Wednesday on the Concealed Carry Podcast. Take care. Be safe. Be responsible. Train hard. And we'll see you then.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. USA Firearm Training and the Concealed Carry Podcast strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in the podcast.